With government funding cuts to PBS and NPR, tech companies playing nice with Trump, and streamers run by algorithms, what's a reasonable reader of The Nation to do? If you're interested in politically engaged documentaries and independent global cinema, try Ovid with a free month-long trial. The Times describes Ovid as a terrific streamer of independent film fans, and IndieWire praises Ovid for being unafraid to program films that matter. A boutique, hand-curated service with over 2,300 titles, Ovid is home to films by auteurs from Chantal Ackerman to Patrizio Guzman to Peter Watkins, with the richest collection of probing, provocative films available anywhere. Sign up at Ovid today and get your first month free using promo code NATION25. That's OVID.TV.
Welcome to the Nation Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of our biggest stories with the journalists who wrote them. I'm Dede Guttenplan, special correspondent for The Nation. Donald Trump and his MAGA movement haven't just taken over Republican politics. They've also taken over Republican fashion. Gone is the stuffy, preppy uniform of the elite. In its place, a loud, anti-establishment, even vulgar sartorial agenda. But what does this style actually signify about MAGA politics? What do these clothes suggest about the authenticity of the movement's leaders and their views, especially when so many of Trump's policies remain old-school conservative? And what messages do these looks send when their words often mean something else entirely? To help us unpack the fashion evolution of the political establishment, we're joined by Derek Guy, better known online as the Menswear Guy, and creator of the blog Dye Workwear. Derek has written for the New York Times, the Financial Times, and other outlets. His essay, From Blazers to Belligerence, appears in the October Books issue of The Nation. Derek, as a longtime reader, first-time chatter, I'm delighted to have you on The Nation podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure to write this for The Nation, since the publication was so important to the formation of my politics as a youth.
Well, speaking of formation of one's politics, I should say right up that you had a big influence on my thinking about fashion, which wasn't really a subject I thought a lot about, as anybody who's ever seen me could tell you, until I started reading your blog, although for a while I thought it was German, so I thought it was Die Werkwehr. So I'm pleased to be set straight on that, and I'm sure you'll set us straight on many other things. And before we plunge into the evolution of the Republican Party and its progress from Brooks Brothers to Brioni suits, I'm going to begin with a question that is more often asked in another internet context, which is, what are you wearing?
I am currently wearing an Ascot Chang button-down shirt and a pair of Buck Mason jeans in their full saddle-cut raw denim.
Okay. I am wearing a pair of hiking shorts and a gray t-shirt with a print of Giacometti's skinny dog on it. But, you know, that's what we're allowed to do when nobody can see you.
Nice.
Anyway, your piece begins with an interesting moment, which is Ronald Reagan's inauguration in 1981 and the, what do you call them, party favors given out to guests at the inaugural. So tell us what those were and why you began with them.
So when Reagan was inaugurated in 1981, the Republican Party commissioned these blazer buttons from Ben Silver, which is still a clothier operating today, although they recently just got out of the blazer button business. Ben Silver is one of the main three kind of traditional American clothiers, maybe four, depending on who you count in this category. But on these buttons, they said, for the inauguration of the president and vice president, and it showed an eagle in front of the Capitol Dome, and in its beak had the names Reagan Bush. And they handed these buttons out because they assumed that the attendees, the VIPs anyway, would have Navy tailored jackets, navy sport coats, onto which these buttons could be affixed, which would turn them into blazers. And it was also assumed that people would wear these blazers.
Because any well-dressed man owned a blazer, or at least a blue sports coat.
I assume you mean a conservative.
I'm thinking about that because I actually was in the same college class as Lisa Birnbach, who wrote the Preppy Handbook, which came out in the early 80s, and which codified these matters for people. And, you know, many people who dressed that way turned out to have more left-wing political convictions than you might expect. But certainly if you were if you wanted to dress conservatively, it was assumed that you would own a blue sports coat and gray flannel slacks.
Yes, I think it's important to note that for the first half of the 20th century, these clothes, button-down collars, blazers, sport coats, suits, rep-stripe ties, all of this, was essentially the uniform of the bourgeoisie and the middle class. And that included liberals, conservatives, included radicals, included leftists, communists, included all sorts of people. But in the post-war period, with the civil rights movement, second wave feminism, anti-war protests, and youth countercultural movements, many people no longer aspired to be that kind of man, meaning the type of man who would go to college, graduate to a corporate job, and then raise a nuclear family behind a white picket fence. So out of this, we see many young people dressing like rockers, rebels, hippies, you know, all sorts of countercultural archetypes. And so I start that essay with the story about Reagan and the blazer buttons because it demonstrates two things. One is that conservatives have often used that traditional, we'll call it a Brooks Brothers look, as a visual symbol of a mid-century America that they like to return to, which is kind of, in their mind, an orderly America with traditional gender roles and kind of an apple pie cooling on every windowsill.
Everyone knew their place.
However we want to characterize it, but I think even most Republicans would agree that that garment symbolizes a kind of mid-century, respectable, orderly America. And it also notes that in the post-war period, as liberals, certainly Democratic politicians and Green Party politicians, continued to wear a coat and tie while doing their job or campaigning for office, but over the course of the 20th century, many liberals, along with many Americans, started to drift away from this as a form of not only daily dress, but aspirational dress. It's not something that they particularly aspired to. But many Republicans continue to not only use it as a visual marker of mid-century America, but they continue to wear the uniform. Hence, when Reagan was inaugurated, they at least passed out blazer buttons under the assumption that people not only had Navy sport coats, but would want to wear blazers.
Right. And one last piece of clothing scholarship, just because it's in the article and it was fun. So for our listeners, what makes a blazer and why is it called a blazer?
So a blazer is a type of sport coat. So we have suits, which everyone knows is a garment where the jacket and pants are cut from the same cloth. And a sport coat is simply a tailored jacket that's meant to be worn with pants cut from a different cloth. A blazer is a type of sport coat, and it simply means a sport coat with metal buttons. It is typically navy, although not always. Sometimes, in certain instances, it has really bold stripes. Those were worn as boating blazers. But a blazer was essentially a sport coat with metal buttons, often signifying belonging to some club. And that might be an alumni association, like you go to an alumni house. It might be a country club. It might be a yacht club. It might be a boating club. It means usually some kind of organization. And on those buttons was usually some kind of stamped insignia showing your belonging to some organization. In this specific case, it demonstrated that you attended Reagan's inauguration.
Right. Okay. So that's one image of Republicans. Interestingly, in your litany of clubs, you mentioned country club. We think of the Bushes, for example, father and son. We think of country club Republicans. And Donald Trump owns a country club, but despite owning a country club, he is not a country club Republican. So how does he signify this, and how does his dress code begin to differ over the years from that of country club Republicans?
I think actually the easiest way to demonstrate this is to understand that the Republican look was rooted in that traditional conservative American tailoring, which was formed by both Jewish tailors and white Anglo-Saxon Protestant customers and clients. And that aesthetic was as kind of the WASP, old money kind of lifestyle was typically want to do, was often about playing down wealth to some degree. So it meant that traditional classic Brooks Brothers, what eventually became a Republican look, meant a relatively soft natural shoulder. It meant a matte silk rep stripe tie. It meant a button-down collar. It meant a four-in-hand knot. And if you look at Donald Trump's personal style, it's not just about the way he dresses, but actually almost anything dealing with his aesthetics. It is not about playing down wealth. It's actually about playing up wealth and reminding you that he's rich. There's he was roasted on Comedy Central. I think it was in maybe like 2010 or so, somewhere around that period. And one of the comedians who was later interviewed relayed that Donald Trump said that the comedians could joke about anything, but they couldn't joke about his wealth. They could not suggest that he had less money than he claims. And I think you see that in his Mar-a-Lago home. You see that in his New York penthouse home. All of his decor, the way that he dresses, signals and is meant to remind you that he's very wealthy. So his suit specifically, he wears Brioni suits with a much more padded shoulder. When he was younger, he used to wear a contrast colored banker collar, which is just a dress shirt that's typically made from a light blue or a striped white and light blue fabric. And then the collar would typically be white. And he, since at least the 1980s, has worn power ties, which is to say a tie in a very loud color, like a balloon red or a balloon yellow, and it would be made from satin, which is a very glossy, gleaming kind of fabric. And this was in the 1980s when he was wearing it. It was the look of a brash new money kind of financier class. And of course, he made his name in the 1980s with the erection of the Trump Towers, the release of the book Art of the Deal, and he was trying to brand himself as this kind of very wealthy tycoon who was connected to success. And therefore, if you stayed at the Trump hotels, or you ate Trump steaks, or you went to Trump University, or you did any of these things, you were also then connected to this idea of success. So whereas WASP played down wealth, Donald Trump's aesthetic is to play up wealth. And his aesthetic has been rooted in that 1980s power suit, power look ever since.
Which we saw, of course, in popular culture reaches apotheosis in Wall Street.
Yes, precisely.
Wall Street the movie, not Wall Street the the place of business.
Yes, precisely. That is, I think, if you wanted a very neat summary of the look and the ethos, the kind of greed is good ethos, that's the film.
Right. And let's go back a little bit, just, you know, because politicians have always used dress to signify something. There's a famous photograph of Adlai Stevenson in Life magazine from 1952, where you can see, like, he's got a hole in the sole of his shoe because he's been doing so much campaigning. You know, and then there was a sort of the skinny ties, narrow lapels of the Kennedy era.
Yes.
You know, and there was Eisenhower with his eponymous jacket. So it's not a new thing to use the way you dress to send a signal. Even John Kerry, when he was running for president, he wore the conventional suits of the 60s and 70s, I suppose to signify that he was no longer the winter soldier.
I mean, you see it, for example, in Mark Kelly. He often, when he's not, you know, in his actual office in Washington, when he's campaigning, he wears a flight jacket to remind people of his military roots. These are often ways that people brand themselves, but also to some degree, it's natural to them given their actual background.
But Trump is doing something more than just a personal brand. I suppose that's what I'm trying to get at or understand is, you know, he's dressed pretty much the way he's dressed since the late 80s. I don't know whether you disagree with that. I mean, I haven't noticed much change in the way he's dressed, except when you said something about the contrasting collar shirts that triggered a memory, because I covered him in New York in the 80s, and I remember those. But other than that, has he changed much in the last decade or two?
No, the only time that you really see him dress differently is really in the 1970s. That's when, and as often young people do, he played with a lot of fashion of his day. He wore these really wide lapels and these big paisley ties. But really, for the most part, 99% of his life after the year 1980 has been about not only a dark suit. He doesn't wear black suits. He doesn't wear gray suits. He's always worn a navy suit, typically a white spread collar shirt. I've never seen him in a button-down shirt, which is the more patrician kind of waspy choice. And then a power tie, usually in red, although he's also worn sometimes pattern ties and yellow ties. But it's always some form of a power tie. And again, I think this is partly, I think at this point it's partly, you know, just a matter of habit. It's just how he's always dressed. But it's also, I think, a deliberate way to brand himself as a wealthy, successful power broker, you know, the art of the deal kind of tycoon.
But if you think about, for example, Mitt Romney as a kind of the last gasp of the conventional Republican aesthetic, what is Trump's style telling us about the larger changes in the party, and what kind of impact has he had, you know, on others in his party, in the way they present themselves?
So I will admit that there is a kind of wrinkle in my article in that America as a whole has dressed much more casually. I mean, nobody wears blazers anymore outside of people that just are fanatical about men's tailoring. So, you know, this has kind of gone, you know, that we're talking about a 40-year period in which all of America has dressed much more casually. But I think one of the interesting things to me about the Republican Party, one of the interesting things to me about politics in general, is how much of it has been shaped by online culture and how much of online culture is about a performance. So I wrote an article for Bloomberg last year about the rise of the alpha male aesthetic, of this like really tight suit, this kind of performative male. And the reason why some of those guys wear tight suits is because their body is their business card. They're trying to get you to click the link in their bio and buy, to convert, to buy supplements, to buy a fitness plan, to buy coaching services, so on and so forth. And in the same way, I think we see a lot of that in politics. One, it's shocking to me how online this administration is, how many essentially content creators to some degree, or shaped by content creators, there are. J.D. Vance is heavily online. He is very aware of many kind of online political thinkers and figures. But there's also this performance. I think it was Michael Wolff who recently noted that there is this rise of a certain kind of political animal that wasn't there historically before the online age, where it's not just a political thinker or organizer or, you know, politician. This person is a performer, in the way that you might go through a carnival and see different performers. And I think that's really notable because, as your, you know, attention is currency online. And the performer is the person that can capture the most attention and hopefully over time convert people to either their beliefs or get out the vote and do all of these things. And to me, Donald Trump's aesthetic and how he's reshaped the Republican Party has been partly about branding the Republican Party not as country club elites, but as more of a populist party. And it's hard to pin that to one specific thing. Not everybody dresses like Donald Trump, although when he was on trial, went to court in Manhattan, it's notable that all of his supporters that appeared behind him, Vivek Ramaswamy and J.D. Vance, and among others, all wore identical blue suits, power red tie, white shirt. So certainly they're aware of the aesthetic, but it's also this kind of general drift towards a more, a less country club elitist look and more of a look that signals some type of political outsidership in the sense of the WASP elite. The WASP elite no longer really dominates American culture, politics, or economics. To me, they're almost a vanished class. I mean, I'm talking about like George Plimpton types are no longer the center of any of these spheres.
If you're online and you follow Whit Stillman, you see that they haven't completely vanished because he,
yes,
he's up, he's out there being cranky.
Yes, but he's also not, I mean, you know, like Elon Musk is much more influential than Stillman, as much as I love his work. I was talking to David Marks, who wrote a book called Status and Culture, which is about how our pursuit of status shapes culture. And he noted that in the 1980s, demonstrating some type of cultural capital might be about being able to hold a conversation about art and literature with George Plimpton at an invite-only New Yorker party. Now it's being able to talk about crypto and exclusive Danish restaurants with Mark Zuckerberg on a private plane or something. I think culture has changed in that sense, in that the centers of power are just completely different. But even the Republican Party does not want to be seen as the WASPy insider because they want to position themselves as outsiders. I think the easiest, neatest demonstration of this is not only how often, but how publicly Donald Trump attends MMA events and shake hands with everybody. I mean, they make sure that everyone gets the footage and, you know, shows him shaking hands with Dana White and all of these kind of fighters and figures. In the 1980s, you could not imagine Alex P. Keaton going to a WWF event. I mean, that would be like beneath him, right? That would be considered vulgar and not respectable and low culture and so on and so forth. So there is, I think, a purposeful rebranding of the Republican Party to demonstrate that they are supposedly outsiders, populist, for the working class, which is often coded as non-WASPy, even though the policies, in my opinion, are still serving the muddied class.
But, I mean, there are lots of strands there that I'd like to pick apart. One is, one is this business of the form-fitting tailoring and suit and using your body as an advertisement. And I have to say that when I first started, it's not so much Trump, because he relies on tailoring that conceals his physique, because he doesn't really have anything to advertise in the way of physique. But the way he dresses, apart from that, always reminded me in the 80s of Bruce Cutler. Do you know who Bruce Cutler was?
No, who was that?
He was John Gotti's lawyer.
Oh, okay.
He was a remarkably belligerent, slightly thuggish, incredibly effective, riveting performer who dressed in very tight suits. He had a barrel chest. He had a shaved bullet head. He wore contrasting collar shirts with satin ties. And it was a kind of like, it wasn't so much a mobbed up look as a kind of handmade to the mob look. And, you know, that was like Trump dressed that way. Roy Cohn dressed that way in the 80s. You know, but in Cutler's case, he was a very... It was almost like he wanted you to see that if he wasn't restrained by the decorum of the court, he could beat you to a pulp. And, you know, and I have to say, I've been fairly close to Donald Trump at least dozens of times, and that thought never crossed my mind. You know, he's just not threatening in that way. He huffs and he puffs, and his supporters can be threatening, but he is not physically intimidating. And he doesn't dress as if to be physically intimidating. But I also wanted to ask about this business of, like, if the Republicans are signifying we are no better than you, because I remember that George W. Bush would sometimes go to a stock car race, and that was always seen as, you know, cosplaying. Look at the Bushes cosplaying at being ordinary people. So why is Trump more convincing?
I mean, that's, you know, you could run that same question over so many things. You know, how did he get away with this? How did he get away with that? I mean, that's really one of the masterful things about him, is that he gets away with a lot of stuff. I sort of feel that J.D. Vance does not have that kind of power. If he were to attend an MMA event, I think many people just would recognize he doesn't belong. For some reason, he has, you know, he's unique in the sense also Trump is, in that in the long history of politicians dressing down, going back to Jimmy Carter losing the jacket, Barack Obama losing the tie, Clinton also losing the tie, Trump unless he's on the golf course, and in extremely rare moments will you see him outside of a full coat and tie outfit. And yet he's able to hold this outsider status. He's a populist billionaire in some strange way. I don't know how he gets away with it.
Well, it's interesting. And, you know, your references to Obama and Clinton, let's talk a little bit about the Democratic version of this. Is there a Democratic version of this?
In the last election, I felt that the Democrats tried to do a very weak effort at this when they released the camo, the hunting camo Harris Walz hat. I mean, it's one of those things where camo and hunting are kind of themes at the moment in fashion. So it plays well with Gen Z, who is aware of fashion trends. But it also was an attempt to try to seem more like Midwestern, working class, outsider, not elite. But the Democrats haven't really gotten away from that kind of college-educated, knowledge worker, scolding middle class, nebbish kind of figure. I think that still is somehow the Democrat branding, and they haven't been able to come across as, you know, like Theo Vaughn, for example, is like a perfect, I don't know if that's his real character or if it's just performance, or maybe he plays up the character. But Theo Vaughn is, I think, the character that many Republicans are trying to seem like, essentially, to court this kind of white working class, especially male vote.
Right. Well, when you said scolding nebbish, I'm afraid I couldn't refrain from picturing Bernie Sanders, and yet we all love Bernie Sanders. Does that have anything to do with Bernie's dress sense, or does Bernie just transcend fashion?
I don't think Bernie comes off as the latte-drinking, city-dwelling, middle-class knowledge worker email job. He just comes off, I think, for most people as an old cranky socialist, which has its own kind of outsiderish charm. But the email worker, latte drinker is kind of this century's version of that WASP elite in the 100 years earlier. They are the middle class. They are the people that have reaped the most benefits in the post-industrial economy. So I think it's, you know, I don't know if Bernie really comes across as that. I think of him as just kind of an old cranky socialist from New York. Not necessarily. It's hard for me to think of. This is not a knock. I don't mean it to be a knock. But, you know, many liberal pundits, basically, I don't want to name names, but many liberal pundits come off as the kind of email job, nebbish kind of, you know, wonk, essentially. And I think that hurts progressive causes.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's hard to woo people politically if they're convinced that you despise them.
Yes, and I think many of the liberal jokes about the South, that kind of stuff does not play well when you are trying to court people who essentially may have not reaped the most benefits in a post-industrial economy, whereas the Republican Party has somehow positioned themselves aesthetically in a way to say that we understand, you know, the kind of like closed steel town worker.
Right. Okay, so although the exteriors have changed, the dress sense has changed, the packaging has changed, the Republican Party still, and particularly if you look at the legislation that Trump has actually enacted, is a party that delivers on the agenda of the capitalist owning class. So let's talk a little bit about this contrast or apparent contrast between the inside and the outside. And also, how much does having a kind of outlaw feel have to do with getting away with that sort of thing? I'm thinking of the kind of T-shirts that we saw after Trump was indicted, or, you know, the over-the-top bling of the Trump sneakers.
Yeah, I think of, for example, when he signed the Big Beautiful Bill, there was a marching band playing patriotic music, and when he finally signed the bill and banged the gavel, I think there shortly after there were some fighter jets that flew overhead. He is a master of spectacle, essentially. Everything really plays into a kind of TV show that makes you want to watch, essentially, what's happening. And, you know, in that bill is still, the Republican Party is certainly much more of a nativist party than when I was growing up. The tariffs are proof of that. The deportations, the discussions of whether or not we're going to roll back who we define as a citizen, birthright citizenship, all of these discussions make the Republican Party much more nativist. However, in the big, beautiful bill, we still see tax cuts weighted towards the rich. We see slashing of social services, starving the state, rolling back, you know, government regulations. And all of that is still the kind of traditional Republican Party politics that I was familiar with and what was historically celebrated by those country club elites. Is Donald Trump going to bring back those manufacturing jobs for that kind of, you know, steel mill worker in the Midwest? I don't know, but it's been, you know, almost 10 years since he's entered politics in a serious way. And in my opinion, very few things have changed for that type of worker. You know, are we going to see a reshoring of manufacturing? I mean, it's hard to see that when the cost of importing the machinery for those factories has now gone up with tariffs. In some ways, to me, the Republican Party has used this kind of aesthetic branding to position themselves as outsiders, while the actual policies that have changed tend to be things that still benefit those with the most money.
Well, I guess that's the question. And, you know, in a way, it's the $64,000 question, or maybe with tariffs, the $200,000 question, which is how much of this is form reflecting content and how much of it is misdirection?
You know, the stuff that I see take up my newsfeed is often about things that feels more like a culture war than actual policies to help the working class, whether that's misdirection or whether that's actual, you know, whether the base is actually really fired up about trans athletes and DEI and all of these things, it's hard to say. I struggle to point to many policies that actually help working class people, but it's hard for me to say whether that's actually the base that actually is calling for all of these things or really just a misdirection by elites. It could be an interplay of both.
No, I think that's probably right. And I think, you know, I thank you for reminding us that fashion is part of culture. And, you know, it was Aaron Breitbart, after all, who famously observed that politics is downstream of culture. So maybe this cultural change is a harbinger of something that we'll see coming. Or maybe it's just an attempt to, like, packaging for advertising. I mean, that we don't yet know.
Yeah, I think most of all, this shift demonstrates how much of our politics is online and how the packaging, the aesthetics is part of the costume that people play online to both catch your attention and to shape the narrative, even in less obvious ways.
Are there particular politicians whose variations on the Trump style you think are interesting and worth noting?
I noted Troy Neals in the article. He's part of the Freedom Caucus, and he's worn the kind of congressional uniform of a dark suit, but with this kind of Trump tie and the gold sneakers. I don't know if there are many politicians who necessarily wear, you know, something that I would say is iconically part of this movement, but all of them are now much brasher. Pete Hegseth, for example, like kind of covers himself in USA flags and pocket squares and belts and USA linings. I think it's hard to pin down a Republican aesthetic at the moment rather than just point to a theme, which is a brasher, more aggressive aesthetic that is often positioning itself as a political outsider, even as they currently run the executive branch, judicial branch, and Congress.
All right. Derek, it has been a real pleasure talking to you. For listeners who are interested and don't yet know, I urge you to check out Dye Workwear. Always fascinating, and you'll learn a great deal. Thanks so much for joining us on the Nation podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on.